man. There's a beverage here, huh?
Does anybody here know how many times I've had to watch Funny Lady?
I'm gonna get that gun of mine, and I'm gonna change you from a rooster to a hen with one shot.
Greetings, everybody. Welcome to Who Shot Ya? My name's Alonzo Duraldi. I'm your host this week, and joining me in the virtual booth, as always, the Queen of the Midwest, Drea Clark. Drea, what's good?
The Queen of the Midwest, firmly in Los Angeles. What's good with me is I'm going to be on another podcast that comes out next week that Alonzo has also been on before. I've been on before. It's called Screen Drafts. But what's good is the episode that we're doing is about Westerns, specifically Westerns made 1993 through present day, which means for the last 2 months, other than movies for this show, which is nearest and dearest to my heart, I have almost exclusively been watching Westerns. Like, I watch a Western a day, if not more. My dreams are of gunslingers and filthy teeth. And I'm very excited to finally do this. And we're ranking, we're trying to come up competitively with the list of, like, it's a super draft. So it's like the 13 most significant, impactful Westerns of this era. But also what's good is, man, I'm excited to just watch some fluff after this. This gal has had her fill of stoicism and violence.
Well, everybody knows the Western didn't really get great until 1993. So you're really, you know, plumbing the apex of the genre.
Okay, you mock, but... and I have seen, as you know, the reason I'm doing it is I've seen so many classic Westerns.
Sure.
But I was actually pleasantly surprised with the range and also with how they are. The more modern Westerns and the ones that I will be playing are the ones that are reconciling a lot of the just inherent, blatant racism, colonialism, misogyny, you know, the fun stuff.
Of course. I kid. There have been a lot of really interesting ones, and I look forward to tuning into that episode. I know it can become a blood sport, those screen drafts. So,
oh my God. Yeah.
I look forward to see how that goes. Also joining us today, podcast royalty, one of the creators of the Thrilling Adventure Hour, Ben Acker, is in the virtual booth with us. Ben Acker, welcome. What's good?
Thanks for having me. Thanks for asking. What's good of late? I read the collected Superman's Pal Jimmy Olsen 1 through 12. I think it's the complete series by your Matt Fraction. And it is terrific. It's so good. It's that counts as what we talk about in the What's Good.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Oh, totally.
I mean, like, a What's Good that's so good, that's even better.
It's just like, it's such a weird, I assume that all of your audience has read Fraction's Hawkeye book. And so, if they haven't, go do that. It's just such a weird character, Superman's pal Jimmy Olsen, who's existed for 75 years and is just living that sure, yeah, okay kind of life. And so he's gotten into just the craziest scenarios, and it all plays in to this nonsense. But it's also like there's throwaway jokes that could be 12 issues unto themselves. It's just, he's the top of his game writer writing a character that nobody super cares about, which is freedom to trick the audience into loving this guy and also just seeing how much he can stretch the thing. It's a joy. It goes down easy. It's beautifully illustrated by the artist who I should know. I should be able to rattle that stuff off. Artist Twitter is going to be mad. Look it up, because he's good. Can I look it up to make sure? It's got a window open.
The old school Jimmy Olsen comics are always just very bizarre. It was everything from him becoming like an alien, you know, member of the Beatles to like, you know, Jack Kirby dragging in the Newsboy Legion and whatever, like, you know, apocalypse stuff he was trying to test out in other places. So is it that bonkers?
It's bonkers-er, and it's Steve Lieber is the artist, and I knew it, and I doubted it, and I shouldn't have doubted it. We follow each other on Twitter. We're all but best friends. and it's great. It's just it's I know Matt to say hello. or a little bit better. And so it's the double nice of like your friend doing a thing that's great that you can like text him at midnight and go, I'm on this page. It's great.
Hey, Alonzo, what's good with you?
I'm so glad you asked. So what you guys can see, because we are doing this Zoom with the video on, but alas, our listeners cannot, is my tree is up. Dave and I got a silver tip fir this year, which is the sort of old school, you know, not a ton of branches, lots of space between them so you can see everything that's hanging off of them. Kind of thing. And we've wrapped all the branches with lights. So rather than going for big bush, you know, like just insanely packed together branches, this is more of the sort of spare minimalist thing that really lets you show off all the doodads that you've got hanging from it. So I'm very happy with how it came out. Dave has done, you know, like 98% of the work of setting it up, and it looks dynamite. And if you guys want to see what it looks like, we have an Instagram account at DXAX tree.
Oh Lord.
Dave created an alt because he didn't want to be too Christmas on main, as it were.
Oh my God. I can't believe you used the phrase big bush on a week where Iffy was missing. And also Alonzo's playing it coy. He has two trees that we can see from here.
Yes.
And there's no part of me that doesn't think there's more around you.
There's also the third one. So.
Oh my God. Good.
The Aunt Peggy tree.
Exactly. Yeah. No.
Peggy. Yes.
A lot of the we're definitely the old school aluminum. We even have a color wheel that I haven't set up yet, but we bought a new one. That's one of the few things you don't want vintage because the old ones had a tendency to catch fire.
I don't know what I'd only know the color wheel by Alex Perry.
Well, a color wheel is the thing that the people used to have, rather than hang lights on an aluminum tree, you would have a light bulb with a spinning plastic wheel with four different colors on it that would rotate and it would project like pink and green and blue onto the aluminum tree.
All right. Educational, Christmas educational podcast right here.
And it's also an Alex Ross Perry film. Yes.
And it is.
One
Alex Ross Perry. Yes. Thank you.
Yes. All right. So big day today. We are discussing David Fincher's Mank. I will be popping up with the I did not name this myself Christmas Zaddy Christmas Movie Minute, of course staff picks, but first it's time for our news segment It a Dick, short for Is This Important, Do I Care. Each of us will read a news segment and answer those very important questions: Is this important, do I care? And I'll be starting us off with the big news from Warner Brothers. They announced last week that they are dropping their entire 2021 slate of 17 feature films on HBO Max. On their premiere date, the films will be simultaneously released in theaters and on the streaming service, and they'll be on the streaming service for 31 days and then come back when the home video happens. And we're talking big stuff out of Warner Brothers. Some of the titles include Matrix 4, In the Heights, Dune, and Suicide Squad, among many others. So you guys, is this important? Do you care?
This is important. I do care. It's been really fascinating to see the sort of cultural response and how that's differing between like my different groups of people that I know. So like people that are more like us that are kind of entrenched in the film world or have some more idea of industry or how long term this could be affected. There's a lot more sort of panicked. Is this going to be a sign of doom for theatrical release in the future? And just exhibition in general. But like my friends in the wider world who are also, I mean, not to say that film people aren't COVID worried. We certainly are, you know, like who shot you? We've not been discussing films that aren't available non-theatrically,
right?
Or digitally. You could call it whatever you want, but yeah, I got there. But the but like that, it is of import to us. But for people outside of it who aren't thinking on the industry side, it's this relief of like, oh great, there's all this new wonderful stuff coming my way and I can't wait to see it. And I think that this is sort of a no-win. I think that Warner, like every conglomerate, is trying to like, what's the best thing they can do for their brand and their money? And I do think this is a smart move. And I also hope that this is the one-time move that they say that it is.
Ben?
Here's my thing. So you know how there's a quarantine on and a pandemic happening at the time of this recording?
I'd heard.
Definitely today there is. Yeah. Right. It may not by the time this comes out. Yeah.
Oh, man. Wouldn't that be great? So,
oh, my God.
Throughout the whole thing, there's been promotion for stuff. And there's got to be. And I understand that. But I don't care about it because I'm just trying to get through the day a little bit. And like to tell me that something's coming out in 6 months in whatever form, like I have sympathy. You have to do that. You made a thing and you're proud of it. You jumped through the hoops. You made the compromises. You made the thing, and that's great. And I'm happy for you. But like, just put it out. Like your promotion is a thing I cannot focus on. And for it to try and come into my field of understanding the world, I don't have the bandwidth for a new CD by Third Eye Blind or whatever it is.
Keeping those references contemporary.
Yeah.
Right. I'm from right now. I have a TikTok account. I don't post, but I watch and I've learned things. The point is that this news is essentially promotional, right? Like this is a business plan, but also like here's the movies we have coming out. And I don't wholly not care like I used to not care. Like optimism, the idea of a future is creeping in, I guess, is the point. Like to hear this thing, if it was before the election, say, I would be like, hey, shut up. Good for you. Who cares? A bunch of dismissive, not quite venom, but not quite not. Yeah. And I don't wholly not care. So that's great. Like I'm moving forward in my heart. I have patience for the world in a different way, and this is helping me to understand that. Ultimately, do I care? No, not really. I think that the movie, it's a good idea to have theaters for movies and other things. I think that that's not going to go away. Do I care? Yes, I guess I care that the studios and companies that could pay me to write a movie for them make money to have to pay me to write a movie for them. And that's too selfish and too. Do I love the movies? Sure. TV's great too. I don't know. What was the question? Did I get it?
Yeah, you said TikTok. That's all we were looking for.
Right?
Yeah, yeah.
Space
that was
girl.
The secret word.
Yeah, I mean, like, obviously this is, you know, another sort of not great bit of news for theater chains, which have had a not great year, but, you know...
Make better popcorn, theater chains.
Well, there you go, for starters. You know, we just talked about on our Thanksgiving episode, our turkeys of the year, and we kind of went after Christopher Nolan for his insistence that Tenet had to open now, and in theaters before really the world was ready for that. And so I think that it's interesting that studio is the one that's like, okay, we tried this and that didn't work. And so we're going to do this. And, you know, I like to think that later when the world is somewhat more stabilized, that people are going to go back and reissue a lot of the movies that are being watched at home right now. Cause yeah, I think eventually there is going to be a substantial number of people who didn't see Wonder Woman 1984 in the theaters and would like to see it projected. And I'm sure that there will be accommodation to that effect. But, you know, I think it's smart. I think they just sort of decided, look, let's stop kicking the can. Let's stop, you know, like futzing around with release dates. We're just going to say 2021 is a wash. And so we're going to pick these dates. We're going to stay with these dates and you're going to watch them at home, or maybe you'll see them in theaters or whatever, but they'll get out there. They'll be in the world. And then at some point, you know, we can all move along and pretend this was just a sorry footnote to our overall history of life and of the cinema. So I don't know.
Oh, then I would just add that they've been toying with looking at day and date release for a long time, which is the idea of having both a theatrical and a digital release on the same day. Obviously, theaters are the one pushing back because to them, that's cutting into their potential profits. But one of the people that was a huge proponent of that is Steven Soderbergh, who has done a few of those releases himself. And he's also the first person who's, or not the first, but he definitely came back to say, like, the theaters are going nowhere. People will always want to see things in theaters. So I think there's like learning curves that were about to be happening regardless of the state of our weird ass world. So speaking of our weird ass world, oh, Letitia Wright. Shuri from Black Panther, both Ben and Alonzo just dropped their heads. Last week, Leticia?
Leticia.
Okay. Last week, Leticia Wright posted a link to a video on her Twitter accompanied by the prayer hands emoji that questioned the corona vaccine and vaccines in general. The video was hosted by Tomi Arayomi, the leader of something called Light London Church. In the video, he questions the legitimacy of the COVID-19 vaccine. And the video also contains climate change skepticism and some fun transphobic comments for good measure. The posting of this video caused outrage from fans and followers. Wright responded by saying, quote, "My intention was not to hurt anyone. My only intention of posting the video was it raised my concerns with what the vaccine contains and what we are putting in our bodies, nothing else." She also said, "If you don't conform to popular opinions, but ask questions and think for yourself, you get canceled." Mm. Leticia Wright has since deleted both her Twitter and her Instagram. Is this important? Do you care?
I love that she's responding to this like a 70-year-old white comedian. That's always a really great move. Mm. Oh, you're being canceled. You know, I'll tell you, our dear friend Winter Mitchell is a digital media strategist. And, you know, when people ask, what is that and why does anyone need one? This is why celebrities need a digital media strategist, so they don't retweet the stupidest stuff that makes them look really terrible. It's like, you know, she's very convincing playing the smartest person in the MCU, but like she's spreading this nonsense disinformation, as you said, not just about COVID, but also about, you know, climate change and this awful transphobia in the thing. You know, look, is there a history of organized medicine doing terrible things to the black community? Yes. You know, and do those things often involve vaccines? Yes. Is there a conversation we had about that? Absolutely. But not from this guy and not in the context of all this other crap that he's spewing out. So, yeah, not a good look for Leticia Wright. I'm a huge fan of her as an actress. Love her in Mangrove and in the Black Panther stuff. But this was painful to watch unfold.
Yeah, the vaccines in general and the anti-vax movement is tricky because on one level, people should question or be open to questions. I love a questioning mind. I love people figuring things out or looking at the science into it.
If you will.
Being inquisitive. Thank you, Mr. Vocab. You're much better at that. And so you'd think that that would be a welcome element, except for it's not actually an inquisitive state of mind. It's just about having an idea already and expressing your opinion as fact, which is problematic anyway. But when it's coming from someone like Leticia Wright, who had millions of followers before, you know, she canceled herself and her Instagram. There's something too. I can't imagine she actually watched the whole thing because there is all this other hateful stuff cooked in along with all the idiocy. And it's also at the very beginning of it, this pastor says clearly, "I don't know anything about vaccines. I am not a scientist, but here are my thoughts for an hour."
Here goes.
Like, cool. Pass that along. Ben, I know you care about this.
Look, any chance to show that I know what the Dunning-Kruger effect is or confirmation bias, I'm going to use this platform to say I know what both of those things are. I don't like any of the stuff that happened because I'm good in my heart. And I don't know. Is that?
That counts.
I think Absolutely. That counts.
Listen, again, we were just looking for Dunning-Kruger. You're really nailing this.
Right. Yeah, if you had that on your bingo card,
you're killing the whole what's good.
Elsewhere in the industry, Matthew Vaughn has directed two relatively successful Kingsman films, Kingsman: The Secret Service and Kingsman: The Golden Circle, with a third prequel film, The Kingsman, in the works. But according to the CEO of his production company, they are nowhere near done. Marv Group CEO Ziggy Kamasa says the production company is working on, quote, something like 7 more Kingsman films, unquote. Is this important? Do you care?
You guys, I want to become just a Kingsman head. Like, all Kingsman all the time. Oh, don't knock to Drea. She's going to bring up the Kingsman.
She's writing like, fanfic.
Yeah. The idea of a Kingsman cinematic universe. They definitely are doing TV shows as well. I definitely enjoyed I think I enjoyed both of these. The first one I found really fun. There's some playfulness to it. Both of them have had absolutely gratuitous nonsense that involved female body parts. Mm. And really interested to see if that's going to be a continuing theme. Yeah, I think that there's a fun to this, but there's also talking about, like, Ben Acker just gained 8 years of his life because this is also just more promotions of, hey, heads up, we're not going to do the work and just release these. We want you to know we're going to be releasing 7 more of these. So just have that live in your brain.
Ugh. I'm okay with promotion I barely know about.
Good.
I hate these movies, so I'm not nice. Particularly excited about more of them, but, you know, I always live for surprise. You know, I didn't like the Madagascar series until 3, so you never know.
Oh my God.
That's where it really
kicks in. I love
that
you just said that.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, they brought in...
De Niro.
No. Noah Baumbach. Noah Baumbach That's co-wrote right. Madagascar 3, and it made all That's the difference.
Right. No.
I somehow really? Know that, too.
Really? Yep.
Oh my God. I'm excited. This Kingsman piece really just took a detour.
Maybe they'll bring him into the Kingsman series.
Yeah,
and then
you
I
don't know.
We'll
have they
something.
Have 7 of them. They got to get their... Ah, oh, you guys. I'm going to come up with a good name for Kingheads. For our, my King...
Would
oh,
there be
no.
a crown involved if it's a Kinghead?
I just don't want it conflated with the crown, you know? Because our
oh,
world's
true,
way
yes.
cooler.
Right.
So much cooler. Oh. Like
Kingsman men.
The Kingsman... Done.
We're going to hash that out during the break. And in the meantime, we'll be right back with some discussion of Mank after we hear about another show on Maximum Fun.
Well, hello. I'm Renee Colvert.
Hi, I'm Alexis Preston, and we are the hosts of Can I Pet Your Dog?
And we got breaking news, we got an exposé, and all the beans have been spilled via an Apple Podcast review that said, this show isn't well-researched. Well, yeah, no duh. Of course it's not. Not since the day we started has it been well-researched. Guessing and anthropomorphizing dogs is what we do.
The Can I Pet Your Dog promise is that we will never do more than 10 seconds of research before telling you excitedly about any dog we see.
I'm going to come at you with top 10 enthusiasm, minimal facts.
We're here for a good time, not an educated time.
So if you love dogs and you don't love research, well, you know what? Come on in to Can I Pet Your Dog podcast every Tuesday on Maximum Fun Network.
Welcome back to Who Shot Ya? I'm your host, Alonzo Duraldi. With me in the studio are...
Drea Clark.
Ben Acker.
And today we are talking about Mank, the new film from David Fincher, now streaming on Netflix. Drea, would you provide us with a brief synopsis?
I hate that brief is capitalized. Casey, I know you did that on purpose. Okay, so Mank is in reference to Herman... Jay Mankiewicz? And the co-writer of Citizen Kang... Nope. I said Citizen Kang, but
Kang
like with
Kodos?
The G. Yeah, I did like The Simpsons. The co-writer of Citizen Kane. And it goes back and forth in time between the sort of 1930s when he is a writer and involved intricately with the workings of MGM, Louis B. Mayer, Irving Thalberg, and of course, William Randolph Hearst and his mistress, Marion Davies. And then the current day is 1940 when he is much further along in his debilitating alcoholism, suffering from a broken leg, and writing what will become Citizen Kane. And of course, reflects back on and weaves in a lot of these sort of fictionalized, potentially maybe fictionalized versions of the previous life he went through at MGM and with all of these people, and also touches upon politics and how the manipulations of media can affect politics and, you know, some other things that people might find topical or not. So, yeah, Mank. Is that brief enough for you, Casey?
It was deliciously brief, Drea.
Thanks.
So this is basically kind of the, in a way, the Citizen Kane origin story. Did this film make you look at the OG any differently? Did it provide insight or, sort of, will you think of Mank when you watch Citizen Kane again in the future?
I will. I mean, it's interesting because obviously, you know, like many of us who, if you took any kind of film studies in school, you watched this movie, you learned about this movie, and it has always been, and rightfully so in many ways, imbued with this sort of magical auteurness of Orson Welles, who's freaking 24 years old when he made it. And when you rewatch it with that in mind, it truly is still bonkers to this day.
I remember my film teacher in film school said, misspoke, and she said that the reason that Citizen Kane is groundbreaking as a movie is because it was the first movie to show ceilings.
Stop it.
And what she meant to say was one of the things that was groundbreaking in this movie is that it showed ceilings. But if she had just said that, I wouldn't still remember it.
Yes. And I hope that every time you watch a movie. Kind of deal, yeah, I would be constantly on the lookout for ceilings if I were you. Yeah,
Orson Welles is responsible for that happening, that ceiling. You saw that ceiling?
Did you see that ceiling?
It's very Wellesian.
Yes, so Wellesian. Yeah.
Spider-Man Homecoming is Wellesian.
Yeah, the Agony and the Ecstasy, which is all about the painting of the Sistine Chapel. It's pure Wells.
Yes. Oh my God. Only you would tie those two, and I'm so glad you did. So, yeah, I've never given a lot of thought to Herman Mankiewicz before. Sorry, dude. Obviously, I'm a little more cognizant of, I don't know why I say obviously, but I have been a little more cognizant of Joseph Mankiewicz's contributions. And Herman is certainly an artist who, as a writer, who had a lot of mark on things in very unseen ways, which is a very writerly way to make your mark. I did find with this film, it made me see elements of truly what he possibly incorporated from his own life into Citizen Kane. But I actually never felt like I really had a handle on that guy by the end of this movie. And I kind of wished I had gotten more, because, you know, like a lot of this is this great portal for people discovering classic film and the people who worked in it. Maybe you'll go read something, you'll watch some other movies. And I certainly started digging into things. And I looked at this and was like, oh, well, step one, I have such distaste for him because of how Mank, like, I was like, oh, this guy's an anti-hero. Like, I don't like almost anything about him. You meet him and he's in this writer's room of very self-important dudes who are like chewing cigars and making clever quips, and then their typist is a woman in pasties. I'm like, fuck all these guys. And then they've been there and they've been meant to be working on something, and they're drawn into a meeting and they're pitching to Joseph von Sternberg, and the whole bit of it is that they prepared nothing and they're just making it up as they go along, and I'm supposed to applaud them for their laziness when, like, how many people didn't get to be in that room anyway. I started to care. Guys.
That you just named the part where I was like, oh, all right, I get what this is.
Wait, like, were you on their side, or you were like, oh, I recognize this?
I like an Algonquin round table situation.
Sure,
right?
And
like,
he was actually in the actual Algonquin round table.
Yeah, a lot of the guys in that room were like George S. Kaufman, you know, people who were part of that.
And I liked the guys and dolls of it. I liked the, we're betting on this ridiculous stuff. This kind of like, it, the, I don't mean to veer off into thoughts about this movie if there's an order, but but for real, that's where I was like, okay. I noticed that it was kind of dry to me before that. And there is a thing about old Hollywood movies, your Barton Fink, say, I don't know.
Singing in the Rain?
Two more examples. Singing in the Rain, right? A third thing. And I respected when this movie that didn't feel hooky in terms of like I don't know what this is. It's a mix of stilted dialogue and not stilted performances, but like a real artificial visual style, but like rich and so like it's a bunch of stuff about a thing I've seen a bunch of times before in a way that I've never seen it before, that started as a distancing thing with me. And then when they started to have fun and wit and that in that scene, that's when I was like, okay, I'm on board. I don't know if it's because it's closer to what I'm used to in that kind of thing, or if it just took some doing to get into the the vibe of this movie to, that yeah. I came to it.
That was, there was more fun represented in that scene. And I love wit, but I would have much rather seen those guys sitting around at a smoky bar in their off time. There's something about the just entitlement of being paid for that and being rewarded for their cleverness. I know too many people who live with that mindset, and I've watched mm-hmm. it. And so I was like immediately, oh no, it's hard to be on your side. Oh, cool. You also are dismissive of your wife and, oh, and an alcoholic who makes everyone enable him. Great. Great, cool guy.
A thing that I learned from, you know, not to name drop, but obviously I've worked for years alongside Ben Mankiewicz, who is Herman's grandson. And he came on Breakfast All Day when we reviewed the film, and he's a fan of the film. He interviewed David Fincher for CBS Sunday Morning and all this stuff. But, you know, I think something that I gleaned from talking to him that I don't know the movie delivers as strongly is the idea that Herman would have been much happier to be like a theater critic or a playwright or like a novelist. Like, you know, he was a talented writer, but he felt like the movies were kind of beneath him, but that's where the money was. And so part of his alcoholism stemmed from this idea of like, I'm a whore. I'm here doing this work that doesn't matter, that's not consequential, because I'm getting very handsomely, you know, recompensed for it. And I think if you'd had more of that in that scene that you're talking about, mm-hmm. where he and the other writers are being all blithe about, oh, here we are in Hollywood, and isn't this stupid? And oh, we're making so much money. I think that might have given it, it would have made it less sort of arrogant white guy, because, you know, the reason that he's acting in that way of being dismissive is because he was dismissive of himself, of squandering his talents on what he thought was sort of a waste of time.
I mean, that was the arc, right? That was like his, I don't remember whose mouth the words were in, but they were like, you'd be a force to be reckoned with if you cared about what you did. And that's what he ended up doing. Like, that's the story.
Yeah. I mean, and also the thing about this movie is like, I think it is a fascinating sort of glimpse into Hollywood of that era. But like, apparently, as with any kind of biopic, like, we shouldn't get too enamored of the details, because apparently, like, the way this movie sets it up is this idea that he writes Citizen Kane as a way to get back at Hearst for underwriting these Upton Sinclair, thank you, ads when he was running for governor of California, and he felt guilty about those ads because they were his idea that he mentioned as a joke, and that Irving Thalberg took that joke and ran with it, which is a cool arc and dramatically works totally well. Apparently none of that happened. Like, spiritually, it is true that he would be more on the side of somebody like Upton Sinclair, but the details of that apparently all made up, which is fine, but it's like, let's not take this to the history books as being a thing that actually happened.
Apparently there's a lot in this movie that is not for reals. I don't know if we're getting to that, but it's based on a debunked Pauline Kael.
Yes, that's where a lot of this starts. And that was kind of my window into all this as a kid, you know, as I was sort of like a burgeoning baby movie nerd. Like, you know,
you came out of fully formed out of the skull of Athena as a full movie nerd.
Yoda inhaler and all.
Exactly. Well, no, when I was 11, I got my mom to drive me across town to the one rep house in Atlanta because they were showing Citizen Kane. And I kept encountering in books and stuff how important this movie was. And it never seemed to be on television. So like, I made her take me to see it. And then within a couple of Christmases after that, I was given the Citizen Kane book, which is a thing that came out where it was the published screenplay with the Pauline Kael essay Raising Kane, where she basically goes out of her way to sort of like make this about Mankiewicz and his contributions and to diminish Welles's, which had a lot to do with the fact that she was very anti the auteur theory, which was being promulgated in the 60s by a lot of male film critics, including the guys who would eventually become the directors themselves of the French New Wave, and, you know, people like John Simon here in the US and Andrew Saris. My thing with that is like, even if Herman Mankiewicz wrote every word of that script by himself, the results of Citizen Kane are indelibly tied to Orson Welles's artistry. So, like, you know, it doesn't matter ultimately to me. I think, like, you know, it's a collaborative thing. And so much of what makes that movie great is beyond what's in the screenplay. So I'm not going to lose sleep at nights. I mean, yeah, I don't want Herman Mankiewicz deprived of any credit he's due. But at the same time, I don't want to, like, give him the sole spotlight and pretend that Wells had his thumb up his ass the whole time that the script was being written.
It's the concept of auteur theory is always interesting to me because the truest visionary directors, I think, are the ones who harness every department well. Mm. And that includes your script. But like if you watch Citizen Kane, if you rewatch it immediately before watching Mank, as I did, for good or for bad, the idea of, oh, how you know, you're bringing in your score, you're bringing in your innovative like framing and composition and there's things in there. I'm like, I would be interested to read the script again and then rewatch scenes and see how you can have a script say like a man looks at a snow globe and then you can watch how they actually filmed that scene and the like, oh, there's these deep superimposed overlays and all this. So yeah, I think that, you know, people love
and ceilings.
To have, oh, apparently, first time you ever saw ceilings was in this movie. Yeah,
people
you're
ran
right here.
Out of the theater. They were scared of ceilings coming into the station.
Right? They're like, forget a train. Did you see that ceiling? Bigger than life.
Now, Ben, you're a writer, and so like, I would love to know what you think about this movie as a cinematic portrayal of a decidedly uncinematic activity, which is the actual act of writing.
Yeah, do you also write fully laying in bed and then just like dictating to a woman who's bringing you
the David Milch way?
Yes.
No, I don't do that. It might surprise you to learn. I don't have a studio providing me with a cabin and a woman and a nurse and a weird alcohol
full case of small situation. Bottles of
of something. I love writing. I love it. It's the woe is me narrative of like writing is hard is a thing that I am constantly tweeting against because it's not. It's, I mean, it can be in whatever respect to other people's process, but like, no, it's great. It's really fun. It's a blank page is a dare. And in terms of the, I think that what resonated with me that you're asking about in this is when the writer with the good sense of self, let's say the strong ego writer, hearing people tell him maybe not do this, and him going, oh, instead of that advice, I'm going to not listen to it. I'm going to do the thing that I did. That resonated with me as writerly. the bad at notes thing, be they you'll end your career this is your friend that you're throwing under the bus in this narrative. Not that one aspires to do that,
but sometimes it just
I could feel the like he wrote what he wrote. He said his thing. They're going to change it anyway. You know, Houseman's going to come in and make everybody sound stuffy. It's fine.
Okay. Speaking of, so as a producer, I very much recognize myself in Mr. John Houseman, who's the producer who, like, you first see setting him up in this house of recovery and who's told him how many days he has. And then within, like, literally a minute of him saying, we have 90 days. And then he's like, what's that? Oh, no, we have 60 days. And then he's just constantly cajoling and kind of eggshell and babying. I was like, oh, yeah, I've done all that. That's producer work right there. Panic. Oh, okay, I have to leave so that I can go and let the director yell at me for a while. And then it would come back here and baby you. Yep. Those all felt real, real.
I'll tell you. I mean, yeah, that seemed like recognizable human behavior. Part of my barrier with this, this was based on a screenplay that was written by David Fincher's father, Jack, and I imagine that David probably reworked it in subsequent years. Mank is so quippy in this movie that it you know, which in the right kind of circumstances, I'm fine with. You know, you mentioned Joseph Mankiewicz, who, of course, wrote and directed All About Eve, which is one of the great quippy movies of all time, which is like, you know, as somebody describes it, a film full of people who are saying the thing that everybody thinks the next day they wish they'd said before. Like, they've all got it at the tip of their tongues. I think Dan, my co-host on Film and a Movie, called it that. But in a biography like this, like, Mank is such a quip machine that it's hard to get a handle on him as a person. And in talking about Kane to Houseman, he says something along the lines of, like, you know, you can't give a full person in 2 hours. You can only sort of, you know, kind of muster up the traces or something like that. And it's like, is this movie sort of giving itself an out here by right. having him say that? I did love Amanda Seyfried as Marion Davis, though.
She's wonderful. She's gotten a lot of accolades and deserving. Also someone who's gotten a lot of attention. I think that the Gary Oldman casting made no sense to me. There's this amazing moment where they have him say, I'm 43. And they literally are not on his face when they say it because they could not be, because Gary Oldman's like 62.
The camera would break.
Yeah. And so I'm like, I don't know. I get that this guy went through a rough life and, you know, alcohol, like, there's plenty of things that sure age people worse. No, I mean, like, that, and also a famously, he literally has all this, a whole scene where he's speaking Yiddish to Marion Davies, and I'm like, oh yeah, classically Jewish Gary Oldman. Like, anyway, the idea too that this was a Netflix project, I think he could have cast me. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's not like the name of Gary Oldman was what was bankrolling this.
Sure.
And I think that was, he did a fine job, but it was not, to me, like, the truest choice.
So, all right, raise your glasses, round table. We're going to vote now. Regarding Mank, would we purchase it on physical media, stream it, or skip it? Let's start with Drea.
I go back and forth. My immediate thought when I finished it was, oh, this is a stream it for me, that it didn't feel as special or as insightful or as whatever as I wanted. That said, even just in the 24 hours since I watched it, what I've been ruminating on in the threads of connecting politics and media and marketing and then how also all those things translate into Citizen Kane itself. So yeah, I'm changing mine. I'm going to upgrade from a thing I never told you before to purchase it on physical media. I do think there's a lot here to commend it.
Lovely. Ben?
My first thought is stream it. If you're going to talk about it on a podcast, it's good form. So definitely do that. Like, if someone invites you on their podcast, that is lovely, and honor them by watching the thing that you're going to talk about on the podcast.
Do the very minimum.
Do the barest minimum. And then I guess if you're into any of the stuff of this, like if you're into old Hollywood stuff, if you're into a Citizen Kane, I don't know that like I'm not going to tell my mom to watch it, you know? But if you like, this is your jam, this is a different way to execute it than I've seen before. And it's a mixed bag, like everything. So yeah, go
like
ahead.
Like life itself.
Look, I don't mean to make everything about life and prove myself to be super profound and thoughtful, but it just so happens, like life, I am that stuff.
I'm kind of the opposite of Dre. I think when I first saw it, I was more inclined to be like, oh, buy this on physical media. I think I was really sort of taken in by the sweep of it all in terms of recreating the period and getting that old Hollywood stuff in there. And there's a lot that I admire about this film. But even from the first viewing and the first flush of it being over, I remember thinking there's an emotional link to this material that I'm not getting. Mm-hmm. And it's now been a few weeks since I've seen it because I had to review it for the theatrical run a couple of weeks back. And it has not stayed with me. It's not a movie I'm thinking about. Dave was just watching it yesterday because we're about to talk about it on Linoleum Knife. And I was sort of looking at it and being like, oh, yeah, okay. Like I'm less excited by it the further away I get from it. So I am going to be solidly stream it for this. All right, we will be back after we hear from another show on the Maximum Fun Network.
Dead Pilot Society brings you exclusive readings of comedy pilots that were never made, featuring actors like Patton Oswalt.
So the vampire from the future sleeps in the dude's studio during the day, and they hunt monsters at night. It's Blade meets the Odd Couple.
Adam Scott and Jane Levy.
Come on, Corey. She's too serious, too businessy. She doesn't know the hokey pokey.
Well, she'll learn what it's all about.
Busy Phillips and Dave Koechner.
Baby, this is family.
My Uncle Tell, who showed his wiener to Cinderella at Disneyland, is family. Do you want him staying with us?
He did stay with us for 3 months.
And he was a delight.
A new pilot every month, only on Dead Pilot Society for maximum fun.
Welcome back to Who Shot Ya? I'm your host, Alonzo Duralde, and in the studio with me are...
Drea Clark.
Ben Acker.
All right, you guys, I'm jumping in because it is time for the minute that brings joy to all of our hearts. That is the Christmas Zaddy Christmas Movie Minute. We are giving Alonzo 1 minute, 60 seconds, to discuss every Christmas movie he saw this past week. Spoiler alert, he saw way more Christmas movies than you did. So, Alonzo, my friend, are you ready?
Let's.
And go.
Okay, so I'm actually going to put a pin in Hallmark this week because I do want to talk about specials, although I have a lot of questions about the ramifications of the Christmas and Evergreen universe, but we'll get to that later. All right, so three big Christmas specials just dropped in the last couple weeks, or the last week anyway. First of all, you had Holly Dolly Christmas on CBS, which is Dolly Parton basically doing a super COVID Christmas special. Almost the entire thing is her on a bench singing and telling stories, and she's fucking Dolly Parton, and it works, so well done. So from the minimal scale of Dolly Parton on the far end, on the Maximalist at Apple TV Plus, Mariah Carey's Merriest Christmas Special, Bananas, Old School Christmas Special, Special Guests. She interacts with the animated Peanut Kids. It totally works. Only Mariah Carey could make this thing pull off. Get the free Apple TV Plus subscription if you need to. You got to see this thing. In the middle is the Jinx and De La Holiday Special from drag queens Jinx Monsoon and Ben De La... I'm blanking. I don't have it in front of
Ben
me.
Ben De La Creme.
Ben De La Creme. Thank you. Shame on me. Anyway, they're brilliant. It's wonderful. You got to watch it.
Woo! Also, Jinx Monsoon and Ben De La Creme were in Happiest Season that
they
we talked
are.
About last week.
Yes, they own the
drag
season.
Queens.
But yes, Ben De La Creme. Sorry, Ben, for losing it on your last name. But yeah, it's a really fun special and like, you know... Probably put together for 10 cents, but they squeezed every cent out of it. Fun costume changes, interesting, wonderfully blasphemous song parodies, just production values, a go-go. It's a lot of fun.
Okay, that's right up my alley. Thank you, Alonzo. I like that you did a little twist, and these were like specials versus the narratives. Very seasonal, very holiday-ish. And as ever, you guys know my favorite thing is to pimp my sweet, sweet friend, because the reason he does these is he wrote a book called Have Yourself a Movie Little Christmas. And in that book, he discusses a whole range of films, most of them with a lot more pedigree than the movies he watches and discusses for us. So thank you and reward him. And yay, Christmas movies.
Merry Christmas, everybody. So hey, it's time for Staff Picks, and it's where we recommend any movie at all in any format. And let's start with Drea.
Okay, so when you get your Apple Plus trial so that you can watch the Mariah Carey thing that he just did, you can also check out an animated film called Wolfwalkers that's coming out now. That's so incredible, and it had a small festival run. It's finally out. It's beautiful work. It's by the same Irish team that did
The Secret of Kells.
Thank you. This and Song of the Sea.
Song of the Sea.
So it's this very Celtic animation, and it's about this girl who's supposed to be hunting wolves, and then she meets someone else, and there's like enchantment, and there's a really a sense of like profound philosophical intent to this. And yet it's still accessible as like a family viewing experience. It looks gorgeous. It's so thoughtful and wonderful. And I can't sing its praises enough. And please think of it, because I'm sure it will be nominated for an Oscar and lose to Pixar's Soul. So check it out while you can.
I co-sign this. Ben.
Look, what I'm not going to do in this part where we recommend movies is talk about The Fade Out by Ed Brubaker and Sean Phillips, which is a graphic novel and not a movie. that takes place in a similar time as the movie we watched today. That would be unethical, so I'm not going to tell you that it is great. What I'm going to recommend instead is The Cat's Meow, which is a great movie that Peter Bogdanovich made about Hearst and Marion Davies going out on a cruise. And it's like a old Hollywood story where nobody really knows what happened, but somebody died on this thing. And it's a murder mystery, and it's got Grandpa from Gilmore Girls as Hearst. And when he's lost for something to say, he tells the band that's on the ship, Charleston, Charleston, and they strike up the Charleston and everyone's got to dance. It's Eddie Izzard is Charlie Chaplin. I think Carrie Always is Tom
Dunst
Mix.
Kirsten Dunst is Marion Davies,
Dunst
right?
is great in it. It's
Joanna
a great,
Lumley is Eleanor Glynn.
Everybody talks about Lumley and Glynn, the part she was born to play. It's just it's characters from this movie we just watched in a whole different aspect. It's a little Shakespeare on a boat, and it's enjoyable every time.
Nice. Awesome.
Well, now, you know, to tie into, you know, Mank on Netflix, I would normally have recommended Orson Welles' reconstructed final film, The Other Side of the Wind, which is also streaming on Netflix, but I think I've already made that a staff pick.
You have.
So instead, I'm going to recommend the latest film from one of my favorite directors, a woman who has now made 3 feature films, and I love all of them. That would be Julia Hart's I'm Your Woman, which drops this weekend on Amazon Prime, stars Rachel Brosnahan. It's a 1970s set story of a woman who is on the run for circumstances that she doesn't entirely understand, and the people who help her out and the resources she finds within herself to stay alive and to keep her foundling baby alive as well. A lot of, you know, 90s and oohs and 2010s and now 2020s movies have really tried to grab the brass ring of the sort of 1970s new Hollywood. And this feels like one of the most successful efforts I have seen to really get that feel just right. She co-wrote the film with her husband, Jordan Horowitz. And I just think it's dynamite. It's one of my favorite movies of 2020. Check it out. It's now on Amazon Prime. I'm Your Woman.
It would be unethical of me to recommend a third thing, but I recommended a Peter Bogdanovich movie. And if I were to be unethical or recommend a third thing, I would say there is a podcast called You Must Remember This that just did a deep dive into Polly Platt, Peter Bogdanovich's sometimes wife, sometimes creative partner. And it is interesting as hell. I won't recommend it. That would be unethical.
It's against the rules for you to say that. So
how dare you?
Yeah, yeah. So people could strike that from the record, but they should listen to that.
Please do not take my non-recommendation.
And you know what? What the heck? Google me and Polly Platt and read the remembrance I wrote about her, the rap about the snowy evening in Dallas we spent together. It was something I'll never forget. Hey, it's time for the show where we read 5-star reviews. If you leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, we'll read it on the air, like this one from Izzy Ogan, who says, I don't really like movies, but I do love Drea, Alonzo, and Iffy, one of my favorite weekly listens. Thank you, Izzy. Well, that's awesome.
Sounds very like she left somebody sweet. Out. She sure ben. Left somebody out. Yes, thanks, Izzy.
I'm sure
they real cool. Been... Real cool, Izzy.
I can't believe they didn't sense you were going to be here.
It's a little rude.
I'm sure if they had called Miss Cleo, they'd know what was going on. Ben Acker, you're a treasure. Thank you for being here. Where can folks find you online?
Oh, they can find me at my Twitter handle, which is the @, and then BNACKER. I left the first E off for savings and because somebody already had it. You can find, I don't know, that's me. I'll link to stuff there. I do the Thrilling Adventure Hour still to this day sometimes via Zoom for the pandemic. I do a sporadic web comic about superheroes and feelings called Kid Midnight. Check that out. And I don't know, more soon? Go to Audible and do Cut and Run. Is it all plugs or just where can they find me? Let me just stick to where you can find me. It's Ben Acker across all two platforms, Instagram and Twitter. That's BNACKER. If you like pictures of my dog, Steven, you will love my Instagram account. And if you like just the best, hottest takes around, if you can handle them, check out my Twitter account.
So
that's
hot.
www.twitter.com. And then there's a search bar on the top right. And it's, again, shift two, that's the at sign.
The at sign, you say? Okay.
Mm-hmm. It's a symbol. And then, and the guy who has the E in his name, Ben Acker with the E in it, nice guy. If you send something to me, but you send it to his, he'll let me know.
At least he's active. I hate the people who take the good accounts and then just never use them.
You mean who has at Drea Clark?
For instance, yeah.
For instance.
At Linoleum, I had the same issue. Drea, my dear, always so good to see your face. Thank you for being here. And hey, if you'd like to support the show, visit MaximumFun.org/join. And if you'd like to purchase a Jumbotron, go to MaximumFun.org/Jumbotron. It's $100 for a personal message or $200 for a promotional one. And of course, the number for the Who Shot Line is WSY8031664. If you have a comment or suggestion about this week's show, tweet at us at Who Shot Ya Pod. Our Facebook group can be found at www.facebook.com/groups/WhoShotYaPodcast, or if you're iffy, /. Or send us an email at WhoShotYa@MaximumFun.org. Our producer is Casey O'Brien. Our senior producer is Laura Swisher. This is a production of Maximum Fun.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.